You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi there. Welcome to the Dr. Nina Show, Outsmart Emotional Eating. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin. I'm a psychoanalyst specializing in eating disorders, and I know firsthand what it's like to struggle. I found the cure to binge eating, and now I help people all over the world create binge-free, happy lives. And on this show, I am here for you too. Imagine waking up and thinking about your day, not your diet. Wouldn't that be amazing? It is possible. So today, we're going to talk about trauma and the relationship of trauma to eating issues. And if I have time, I'll open up the phone lines for callers. If you're on the Instagram live stream, feel free to leave a comment or a question anytime. Okay, so have you ever found yourself binge eating after a difficult experience? You are not alone. There's a strong relationship between trauma, both past and present, and binge eating disorder. Not just binge eating disorder. So binging, because a lot of times people will say to me, well, I ate four cookies. Well, that's not a binge. That is not a binge. Binge eating refers to eating a lot of food in a short amount of time and feeling like it is impossible to stop. And when it happens consistently, it may be binge eating disorder, which is a diagnosable and treatable condition. Binge eating disorder is also very much about guilt and shame and self-recrimination and affects your self-esteem. It's just the worst. And it is treatable. You really can have the cure. Now, everyone has different reasons for why they binge eat, but usually it's because they're trying to cope with something difficult, a difficult emotion, some conflict. They're trying not to think about something. Sometimes when you're thinking about food or you're eating food, it's a way of distracting yourself from thinking the thoughts you don't want to think or feeling the emotions you don't want to feel. And sometimes, if not often, these emotions are unconscious, meaning they're hidden out of awareness, but not out of operation. So eating makes you feel better in the moment. It temporarily helps you forget, you know, what's going on, or temporarily distracts you. It numbs difficult emotions. It prevents you from thinking about things, memories maybe you don't want to remember. It provides a temporary sense of comfort, but it is a way of distracting from difficult feelings and experiences. Of course, that relief only lasts like a little bit, and then it leaves you feeling shame and guilt. Now research, the statistics on research are a little lower than what I have found in 20 years as a clinician, primarily, in fact, completely, with one exception, treating people with eating disorders. And the one exception had a child who had an eating disorder. So in 20 years of treating eating disorders, people with eating disorders, I have seen, I would say probably 85 to 90% of them struggle with a history of trauma. The studies say that it's around 50% of people who have binge eating disorder report a history of traumatic experiences. And that trauma includes physical, emotional, sexual abuse, neglect, or other adverse childhood experiences. I think the number is a little bit higher. In my experience, it's much higher. Now, of course, not everyone who struggles with binge eating has a history of trauma, and not everyone who struggles with through traumatic experience will develop binge eating disorder, because binge eating disorder is a complex condition. It can have multiple contributing factors, and each person's experience is unique. But trauma always causes a range of emotional responses that then affect you throughout your life, not just the traumatic situation or situations. It affects your very sense of self. It leaves lasting sense of shame, guilt, low self-esteem. And, you know, if you feel bad about yourself, you can't feel bad about yourself and soothe yourself, right? It's impossible to to hate on yourself and then somehow come out the other end loving yourself. You can't hate yourself into loving yourself. And you know, emotional eating, using food in some way to cope, to soothe, becomes the go-to because it's reliable. Especially with trauma, they usually involve other people. Other people can be unavailable, unpredictable, and unreliable. Food is available, predictable, and reliable. So often we can count on food much more than we can count on people. So we turn to food for comfort instead of perhaps to people and instead of comforting ourselves. Now, often when I talk about trauma, people say, well, nothing bad ever happened to me. I didn't have a traumatic childhood. I mean, yeah, my mom was always critical, but you know, that's not traumatic. Oh, but it is. So there's this misunderstanding of what trauma is. It's often very misunderstood. A lot of people think they have not had a traumatic childhood. They believe other people have it worse. What are they complaining about? Again, it's important to remember everyone's experiences and perceptions are valid and unique. And that goes for you too. It is not productive. It is not helpful to compare traumas or minimize our own experience. So let me give you an example of Samantha. And as always, when I talk about people here, I am not using their real names. So Samantha often found herself binge eating when she was stressed or anxious. And she brushed off the idea that this was in any way connected to quote unquote trauma. Because she said she'd never experienced anything traumatic. She said she had basically a normal childhood. Nothing bad ever happened to her. So this was not related to trauma. So here's Samantha's history. She grew up in a household where her emotional needs were not met. Her parents owned a business. They were preoccupied with work, with their own problems, and they didn't really provide the emotional support and validation that she needed as a child. She was really left on her own to deal with things. And in fact, if she felt bad, she would be told about all the people who had it worse. So she didn't know that that is actually emotional neglect, and that that emotional neglect she experienced is considered a form of trauma and had contributed to her binge eating disorder. She couldn't rely on her parents or her family to be there for her, to nurture her, to comfort her, to soothe her. So she used food, which is a symbolic representation of nurturing, mothering. We talk about comfort food. We really are talking about a wish to be comforted. And like Samantha, a lot of people think of trauma as this intense, severe event, this awful thing that significantly threatens your life, and it's just terrible. You know, Samantha thought trauma was an event like war or a natural disaster or, you know, horrible sexual or physical abuse or domestic violence, or, you know, the loss of a loved one. This is what she thought was trauma. And this is what a lot of people think is trauma. And it is trauma, but it is only one type of trauma. And that is called big T trauma. It's also known as capital trauma or complex trauma. So big T trauma involves significant and severe threats to a person's physical or psychological well-being. And those are the kinds of experiences that have, you know, lasting effects on your emotional health, your functioning. They can lead to PTSD, depression, anxiety, all kinds of disorders, which often binging is a way of coping with all of those. So that's big T trauma, which is the big, bad, awful thing. Life-threatening often. So a second type of trauma is called little T trauma. And that refers to experiences that may not be as severe or life-threatening as big T trauma, but they are still traumatic. So examples of little T trauma are things like bullying, emotional neglect, financial instability, divorce, breakup, job loss, chronic illness. These things are traumatic, and they negatively impact our sense of safety, our sense of security, and our self-esteem. Because often people think when bad things happen to them, especially children, they somehow think They've brought it upon themselves. What did I do to make this person neglect me? What did I do to make this person yell at me? What did I do to make my parent depressed? Kids are naturally egocentric, which means they naturally think that like everything revolves around them. It's like, you know, like a kid who's told, you know, their parents are getting divorced, and the kid's like, well, what did I do wrong? Because kids really think that everything that happens in their lives somehow is a result of them. And this is actually a strategy for hope. If it's you, and if you made the bad thing happen, then you can just figure out what's wrong with you. You could figure out, you know, where you're too much or not enough, and you could change. And then the world will change with you. Then you could have the treatment that you weren't getting. That's the illusion, that if you could just fix yourself, figure out what's wrong with yourself and fix yourself, then people are going to treat you differently. So it actually gives hope for kids to think that they are somehow to blame for the way that they are being treated. The problem is that those kids then grow up into adults who now carry with them the conviction that there is actually something wrong with them, that they are too much, they are not enough. And this becomes their way of being in adulthood. And if you don't feel like you're good enough, you can't really be there for yourself. So food is there for solace, for comfort, to fill the void, to do whatever it does, because it does a lot for us. It's a frenemy. It does something for us. It's a friend, but it also is an enemy. It sure hurts us. And that's why, you know, self-esteem is so impacted by all kinds of trauma. No. So both of these types of trauma, big T trauma, little T trauma, they have effects on the way we feel about ourselves, with others, and in the world. The emotional neglect that Samantha experienced had a lasting effect on her. Since she couldn't depend on her parents for consistent and available emotional support, she turned to food as a substitute for comfort and to fill the lonely void within. You know, her parents had this business and they were always gone, so she would come home from school. She was a latchkey kid. She would come home from school and they wouldn't get home until much, much later. She would spend hours just by herself to her own devices, sometimes like getting really scared and hearing weird noises in the house. And you know what kept her feeling good was just eating, because it was comfort. So she never knew any other way to comfort herself. Any other way of coping, and binging was her primary way, really her only way, of dealing with uncomfortable situations. So trauma can manifest in very different ways. Not all traumas are visible. Not all traumas are obvious. Emotional neglect and verbal abuse may not be as visible as physical abuse or physical neglect, but it still has a very significant impact on our mental and our emotional well-being. So again, as you could see, one legacy of trauma is that people feel bad about themselves, somehow flawed or defective and not good enough. And I just want to take a pause. If you're watching the live stream and you have a comment or a question, please feel free to leave a comment in the comment box. Let me know how this is resonating with you. If we have time, I'll see if I can take callers later. But if this is resonating with you, or if you have a question about trauma or about your own experience, I'm here to help. So again, there's the comment box. Okay. So trauma shakes the foundation of our identity. That is a strong, bold statement, but it's true. Traumatic experiences shake the foundation of our identity. It changes how we feel about ourselves. It leaves us feeling disconnected from ourselves. It leaves us disconnected from others. Because when you grow up in traumatic circumstances, it's hard to trust other people. It's hard to depend on other people. They could leave you. They could hurt you. They could neglect you. They could abandon you. They could reject you. And so food, which represents people in a way, becomes the go-to. And trauma makes us question our worth, our value, even our place in the world. And it leaves us feeling powerless and helpless and hopeless. Okay, questions. Why am I okay all day, and in the evening, I must have sugar? This is the most common question I get. Why am I okay during the day? I'm good. I don't even think about it. I'm like, everything is normal. And then at night, it all goes to hell. Okay, so during the day, we are busy. We are occupied. We're doing things. We're working. We're talking to people. We're taking care of kids. Or, you know, we're busy living our lives, and our lives are often very full during the day. At night, that is when that slows down. And that is when certain feelings or thoughts or discomfort or some inability to be with ourselves, all of the above, become more available. Those thoughts might become more available, or feelings might become more available. And because we don't want to get in touch with that, again, it's out of our awareness. We're not like, oh, I'm having this thought, but I don't want to have it, so I'm going to go to the kitchen. It's more like, before we can even have that thought consciously, before we can even feel the feeling consciously, we go to the kitchen or the drive-thru or wherever, DoorDash. So nighttime is when it's hard to be with ourselves. If you have trouble being with you, then you're going to use food as a distraction. Or if you don't have another way of comforting yourself, you're going to use food for comfort. So be very curious about, if you weren't eating at night, what are the scary thoughts you might have? What are the scary emotions you might have? I've told this story many times, but it actually relates to this very question. My first group for women who struggle with binge eating, most of the group was on board with the idea that they were binging out of, you know, some way of coping. Binging, by the way, it is not a food addiction. It is not about willpower. It is not about control. It isn't even about food. It is a way of coping. But there was this one woman in the group, and she said, no, I'm not coping with anything. My life is good. I just need to lose 20 pounds. I just need to stop binging and lose 20 pounds. That is all that's going on. There are no deeper meanings. She'd be like, Dr. Nina, sometimes, you know, not everything has a deeper meaning. Sometimes, you know, a rose is a rose is a rose. Even Freud apparently said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar and not a phallic object. I don't think he put it quite that way, but that's the idea. And at the end of this group, at the very last session of the group, which was limited in time, and like 20 minutes before the end of the very last session of the group, she said, you know, actually, maybe if I weren't thinking about food, if I weren't thinking about the 20 pounds, if I weren't binging, maybe I think that I want to leave my husband, right? This was the thought she couldn't have at night. This was the thought she couldn't have ever. It was much easier for her to, as hard as it was much easier to focus on her weight and on food than it was to get in touch with her dissatisfaction in her marriage. So if you are turning to food, if you are thinking about food, if something's going on that you're doing something you don't want to do, like turn to food, or you're not doing something you want to do, like, I don't know, exercise or, you know, whatever it is, there's always a reason. And you got to be really curious about that reason. Can binge eating be an addiction to numbing out? Well, yes, but let me just address, Sheila, I think yes, but I object to the word addiction. The word addiction to me, even though, yes, I co-edited a book called Beyond the Primal Addiction, in which I wrote a chapter on food addiction, but it was like, you know, the whole point of the chapter is there's no such thing as food addiction. Despite that, where's my book? Beyond the Primal Addiction. Here it is. Beyond the Primal Addiction. I hate the word addiction. Hate it, hate it, hate it. I think it is a pejorative word. I think it makes people feel bad about themselves. Then they feel like addicts. But if we're going to talk about addiction, you're not addicted to the substance of food, even though it feels like it. You're not addicted to sugar. You're addicted, and yes, Shayla, you're putting it really well. You're addicted to what eating does for you. So you're addicted to using food to escape, numb out, relax, or whatever. That's the coping mechanism. You're using eating as a coping mechanism. So technically, yeah, it's sort of an eating addiction, using food as an addiction to numb out. But I would put it a little bit differently because I think language is very important. And we talk about addiction, there's like a, ugh. Like I said, there's like a negative slant to that word. But if you say it's a way of coping, using food as a way of coping, numbing out in that way, yeah, absolutely. Hopefully that answers both questions. Keep them coming. I'm happy to help. Okay, so trauma can also distort the way we see other people. It creates a distorted view of the world. It leads to feelings of mistrust, fear, anxiety. When you grow up and you don't feel safe because the people that you depend on to take care of you are not making you feel safe, then how do you imagine that the world is safe? No, the world becomes just a wider version of your own family or your own circumstances. So it impacts our ability to have healthy attachments, healthy relationships. It leads us to feel isolated and lonely. And when you're isolated and lonely, and loneliness is felt as a void, an emptiness within, guess what symbolically fills that void? Yes, food. And trauma has an impact on our sense of safety, our sense of security, uncertainty, which is horrible, and instability makes it difficult to trust other people and therefore trust relationships. We might always feel like we're constantly on guard, having to be hypervigilant, trying to anticipate or avoid potential threats. So you can never relax. And guess what? If you can never relax, guess what helps you relax later, often at night? Eating a bunch of carby stuff or just sort of sedating yourself with food. So if you're always hypervigilant, you're always anxious because the world is a scary place, food helps you relax. It helps you cope in that way too. And food is a constant in a world that feels chaotic and uncertain. Food is something you can count on always. It is there. It is there day and night. You know where to get it. It's always available. It's always the same. And unlike people, food doesn't change. It doesn't let us down. So for people who have experienced trauma, this predictability of food and this constancy of food and this availability of food can be a real source of comfort and stability. It's the one stable thing in your life, the one constant. People can be nice one day and then they can ghost you, or they can be rude, or they can say something nasty, or they can just disappoint you. That doesn't happen with food. You know, if you eat chocolate, it's going to taste like chocolate. You're not going to eat chocolate and have it taste like, I don't know. What's like a gross thing? Eggplant. Although I like baba ganoush, but anyway, you get my point. It's predictable. So food is available. Also, you can get it no matter when you want it, no matter where you want it, where you are, there it is. You don't have to do any social interaction. And unlike people who can be unavailable, can always have what you want. You can't have more friends or a more of a better relationship with people. You can't order up like a great relationship. If only that were the case, wouldn't that be awesome? I would like an emotionally available, present, kind, funny, intelligent, creative person. Yes, please bring that person to my door. Wouldn't that be great? Maybe someday in the future. We don't live in that world. So we live in a world where people can be scary. Food is always there. And especially if you've had a history of trauma and you find social interactions, certain kind of social interactions to be upsetting or scary or unnerving, or you've got to like gird yourself for them. You've got to like, you're constantly observing yourself as you're having an interaction with someone else. Food can just be it, like, you don't have to do that. You don't have to observe yourself. You can just be, you can just have it. It's easier than people. Also, people who have experienced trauma struggle with feelings of shame, guilt, self-blame. They feel responsible often for the trauma they experienced. For example, Samantha had this idea that if she were somehow better, if she got better grades, if she were a more interesting kid, if she were different, then maybe her parents would not spend all their time with their business. Maybe they would come home and be with her. So she really blamed herself for this neglect. And like Samantha, many people who've experienced trauma feel responsible for not being able to prevent it. This is very true in childhood sexual trauma as well. That would be a big T trauma, not a small T trauma. Feeling as if somehow it happened because of them, or they should have been able to stop it, or they should have told someone, or they should have, woulda. Total shooting on themselves. And this sense of over-responsibility, where it is not your responsibility as a child to prevent abuse, leads to self-recrimination, negative self-image, sense of worthlessness, all of these things, which if you feel bad and you feel bad about yourself, guess what? Eating makes you feel better. It takes you away from that. It puts you in the binge zone. You're just not feeling anything. You're just in that moment where you're free for a moment, for a little bit. And then of course, all the horror comes back. So it is possible I've told you all the horrible results of trauma, but guess what? It is possible to heal from trauma and rebuild a positive sense of self and self-identity. When you have support, when you have treatment, when you have the right guidance, you can learn to integrate like what happened into your life in a way that isn't so negative about yourself. And you become resilient and you have a more positive view of yourself. You're no longer feeling bad about yourself because of what happened to you. It's like, yes, this happened to you. And your interpretation of it was that there's something wrong with you. You're too much. You're not enough. All the things. But that was an interpretation. That's not reality. And you can find a new way to feel good about yourself. When you feel good about yourself, you can be there for yourself at night or anytime. You can soothe yourself without food. You can give yourself comfort words instead of comfort food. And you can turn to other people for comfort, for understanding, for connection, instead of turning to food. Because when you feel safer within yourself, other people feel safer too. So I guess I kind of want to go back and look at how trauma leads to binge eating. Because again, as I've been saying, and as you likely know, binge eating temporarily protects us from tough emotions. That's why it's the frenemy. Helps us, distracts us from pain, provides comfort, soothing, just, you know, helps us escape for the moment. And of course, it's an enemy because it undermines our sense of self. It negatively impacts our emotional and physical health. So binge eating is not the problem. It is the solution to the problem. The problem is some difficulty identifying, expressing, and processing difficult emotions. And when we tackle the root causes of binge eating, the true problem, we can break free from those destructive behaviors and achieve really freedom, liberation. Again, I want to mention, this is why I don't believe in recovery. Recovery is waking up every day and saying, I'm going to be good. I'm going to stick to my plan. I'm going to be good today. It means always thinking about what you're eating and not eating. And that's terrible. That's horrible. Who wants that? Liberation is waking up and thinking about your day, not your diet, because binge eating is a thing you used to do and it's not anymore. You used to do it. Now you don't. It's not a lifetime sentence. It's something you do. So it can become something you did. Very important. Olives. Help me understand what you mean by olives. Radames, I know I'm butchering your name. I'm sorry. Olives. You know, olives, maybe you associate olives with a certain memories or certain times, certain people. Did anyone give you olives and or anyone that you had a good relationship give you olives? The other thing about olives is like there's a missing piece in it. Like I think he hates that. Oh, now I get it. Chocolate won't taste like something nasty like olives. Got it. Thank you. I was temporarily lost. I thought you just put olives and I was just like, what? Okay, that makes sense. Yes, chocolate will not taste like olives, which are pretty nasty. I'm with you there. Unless they're in a martini, in which case, okay, every once in a while. Yes, and he hates them, right? Okay. Glad we cleared that up. Thank you. So for Samantha, binge eating was a source of comfort that helped her manage feelings of emptiness and boredom. And for other people, it can be a way to distract from uncomfortable thoughts, uncomfortable emotions. It can be a way to pass time. It especially in this world that we live in, which is all about productivity. Go, 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 do. And I am all for productivity. That may come as no surprise to you. But if we are always feeling like we've got to be doing something, then relaxing can feel like being lazy. This is something else I hear a lot. Oh, I was so lazy. You know, I worked 12 hours and then I came home and I was so lazy. Well, you can't work 12 hours and come home and be lazy. Like those things don't go together. But what this person was saying was that if they're not doing something all the time, they feel lazy. So they're either productive or lazy. Sometimes eating can be a way of giving yourself just me time. Time for you. You're not doing something for other people. You're not, you know, you're just giving yourself that break, that me time. It gives you a little bit of a break from caretaking, caregiving, doing for others, right? So it's a form of doing. It's when you're eating, you're actually doing something. So you're doing something, but you're giving yourself some time. If that resonates with you, then you got to find other ways to give yourself that me time and challenge the notion that if you're not constantly doing and producing and all of that, that you are lazy. We can't work 24/7. We're not human doings. We are human beings. I think Gandhi or someone like that said that originally. We are human. I'm not, maybe not. You can source me on that. I would love to know the answer. But we are not human doings. We are not here to do, achieve, produce only. we also need to rest, have fun. By the way, if you're not having enough fun because you're always busy doing, eating can be fun. So if that resonates with you, think about fun things that you could do that don't involve food, but the more fulfilling, notice the language too, for fulfilling, satisfying, gratifying things that you're doing in your life, the less you need food for satisfaction, fulfillment, gratification, fun. Also, eating or focusing on food can be a way of displacing powerlessness in some areas of your life onto food. So if you're feeling powerless over a situation at work, Dalai Lama. Yes, it was the Dalai Lama. Thank you. Thank you. If you are feeling powerless over a situation at work, for example, you may focus on having control over food instead. If your boss is driving you crazy and there is nothing you can do about it because your boss is the boss from hell, there is nothing you could do to change your boss. But there is something you can ostensibly do about food. You might displace, oh, I feel so powerless over this situation, to, oh, no, I feel powerless over this, and I could have power over food if only I got control. So you can see how that also works. So even though binge eating can make us feel better in the moment, it also makes us feel really, really bad afterwards. You feel guilty, feel ashamed, you feel disgusted with yourself. And over time, of course, it can lead to physical health problems. And so that's why it's so important to look at the underlying reasons for why you're binging. What are those roots? If you pluck a weed, it will grow back because you haven't gotten to the root. So we got to get to the root, which like a real root that's underground, it's hidden from us. We can't see it, but we know it's there because it's growing the root. We have to dig out the roots in our unconscious minds. We're in the dark about it. It's hidden from us, but when we see it, we can dig it out. And then we can plant, let me just extend the metaphor. Then we can plant new seeds and grow them. And then you have a beautiful flower instead of a weed. I have a hard time, Sheila's saying, I have a hard time understanding why I keep going back to dieting. It's so automatic. Well, what is dieting? Think about what does dieting do for you? Does it make you feel as if you have some sense of structure? Does it keep potential chaos at bay? But, you know, it is structure, but it is a structure that hides you from yourself. Diets just focus on what you are eating and not why. And they are always about restriction in some way. And the either the experience of deprivation or the anticipation of deprivation always makes us want something more. So dieting is always a setup for binging. That's why it's called the diet binge cycle. So if you need more structure in your life, how about getting that structure, or if that's what it is, get it from something other than a meal plan. Think about what dieting does for you or what you think it does for you, and find out how to get that elsewhere. If dieting gives you structure, there are other ways to get structure. If dieting gives you a sense of community, you're not the only person dieting, you're in this whole group of dieters, find another community. Food for thought. I look forward to your thoughts. So dieting, again, it only focuses on what you are eating and not why. So you have to look at what's eating at you. So if you find yourself, for example, turning to food out of boredom, or if you're obsessing over every calorie, carb, or fat gram, it's important to recognize that there is an underlying reason for that. And it might be difficult to pinpoint exactly what is triggering, you know, what's going on, but there's always something deeper going on internally. And when you explore what's underneath, oh, the other thing, Sheila, I will ask you this. What are you not thinking about if you're thinking about diets? Just like, what are you not thinking about if you're binging, or if you're thinking about food? If you're turning to something or to thoughts of something, what thoughts are you not letting yourself think? Just like the woman who couldn't let herself think about the fact that she was unhappy, deeply unhappy in her marriage, wanted to leave her husband. She couldn't think that thought, and she didn't have to worry about it if she's constantly obsessing over those 20 pounds. Dieting, focusing on weight, that kept her from thinking the uncomfortable, scary thought. What's your uncomfortable, scary thought? Whatever it is, you can deal with it. I promise you that. And by exploring this, by looking at what it is that you do not want to think, okay, Sheila's writing down these questions and you're going to do some. Good. I love that. Awesome. Also, for those of you who may not know this, this show is on LA Talk Radio live every Wednesday, but then it is made into a podcast, and you can get it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get podcasts, or on the LA Talk Radio archives. So if you missed what I was saying, don't worry. You can go back and you can listen to the show or watch the show again. When you dig out those roots, or even just go looking for them, be curious. Be curious, not critical. You get a better understanding of your why. Instead of focusing on what you're eating, focus on why. What's eating at you? One thing that you can do, here are some steps. Sheila, I hope you have your pen with you. So keeping a food mood journal is one thing that you can do to get insights into what is the relationship between what you're eating and what you're feeling. You put down, like, what did you eat, when, and where, and what were you thinking and what were you feeling? So you just kind of keep a journal of what did you want to eat, what emotions and thoughts were associated with that, and what time and where were you when this happened. This helps you connect the dots between your eating habits and your emotional well-being or conflicts. So again, where, when did you eat? Record the time, day or night. What did you eat? Jot down the type of food. Where were you? Were you at home? Were you somewhere else? What were you thinking? What was on your mind? Weren't thinking about food. If I could just wipe away all thoughts of food and weight and body image and all the things, what would be on your mind? What would you be worried about? What might you want? What might you be hungry for that's not food? And how are you feeling? And by the way, fat is not a feeling. Mad, sad, glad, afraid, worried, anxious, hopeful, irritated. Those are feelings. Also, were you physically tired? Like I said before, many times people eat to wake up, to give themselves like some extra energy. But when you're tired, what you really need is some rest. Now, I realize that's not always possible, but even if you take 10 minutes to just relax, that is much better. And that's giving yourself what you need. That's giving your body what you need instead of eating some sugar to try to pep yourself up. So by tracking what you eat, when you eat it, and how you're feeling before and after those meals, you can begin to see connections between your emotions and your eating habits. And that can help you recognize when you're using food as a coping mechanism to deal with difficult emotions or stressful situations, or if you're trying to avoid certain thoughts. The other thing that you can do that's very important is to convert your inner critic into a friend. It's really impossible, as I said before earlier, you can't hate yourself into loving yourself. That has never worked and it never will. So you know, if you have an inner voice that is constantly telling you what you're doing wrong, you're no good, you're not good enough, you don't deserve happiness, you're a loser, they don't really like you if they knew the real you, blah, 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 you know that voice. Well, those negative thoughts, they really take a toll on your sense of self and they prevent you from living your best life. Oh, that horrible inner critic. But there is a way to silence that voice and liberate yourself from that critic. And one way to identify your inner critic, because it becomes so commonplace, people don't actually realize they're being self-critical until I ask them, would you say that to a friend in your situation? No, I'd never say that. You know, people who are like, oh my God, I hate myself. I'm so disgusting. I looked in the mirror and I just thought, you're gross. Oh, would you say that to a friend? No, never. I wouldn't even think it. So your critic shows up for you, but nobody else. Yeah. So one way to identify it is when you talk to yourself in the second person. If you say things to yourself like, you're not good enough, instead of I'm not good enough. You're going to fail instead of, oh, I'm afraid I'm going to fail. See the difference? It's easier to talk to yourself in a mean way when you take that second person voice. But by the way, who's talking? Who is that you? Who's talking to you in that mean voice? Where did you learn that mean voice? But when you catch yourself in the act of negative self-talk and either switch it up and try to change the you to I, which is really hard because often it's hard to be mean to yourself from an I pronoun, although some people can do it just fine. When you begin to recognize and challenge the harmful messages that your inner critic is giving you, you can start being free of them. You can start breaking that up, breaking that cycle, breaking up with your inner critic. Now, imagine your mind. I only have a few more minutes, so I'm probably not going to get through all of this, but I'll try. Imagine your mind is a courtroom. Your inner critic is a prosecutor, and there's an internal defense attorney on the other side. And when the prosecutor accuses you of not being good enough or of being this or that, you can object. The defense attorney can object and demand evidence for those accusations. Remember, feelings are not facts. Feelings are not admissible as evidence. And then challenge the idea that there is something wrong with you, that you should be in a different place in your life or whatever it is you're accusing yourself of. Give your inner defense attorney an equal opportunity to be heard. And also, let's have the prosecutor, define what good enough means. Is it your weight that makes you not good enough? What other criteria form the basis of this accusation? By presenting alternative evidence to the court, the inner court, such as the fact that you're proactive, hopeful, you're willing to consider new perspectives, you have really great hair or eyes. Like, don't all make it about your internal self. Also look at your appearance. If you're only looking at yourself and finding things that you don't like, that's all you're going to see. How about look at the things that you do see that you can like? Maybe you like your smile, you like your eyes, you like your hands, you like your strong legs or your whatever it is. Just start looking and noticing the things you like about yourself and not just your appearance and not just the things that you don't like. So this is a way that you can challenge this belief that feels like facts that you're not good enough or that you're too much or not enough. And we're almost out of time. So let me just say that trauma, again, can take many forms. It has a long lasting effect in your life. You need when you are able to acknowledge and work through that trauma that is contributing to binge eating, because trauma affects your relationship with yourself, your relationship with others, your relationship with the world. When you can take a step back and be nurturing to yourself, challenge your assumptions, be kind to yourself in a different way. It's challenging to do this, but it is possible. So remember, you learned this way of relating to yourself, relating to the world, relating to other people, and you can learn a new way. Healing is a process. It takes time and patience. So be kind to yourself, stay curious, not critical, and never give up, because you really can create a binge-free, happy life. So that is our show for today. Thank you so much for joining in. I am Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, psychoanalyst, here to help you create a binge-free, happy life. I am live every Wednesday at LA Talk Radio at 11 a.m. Pacific, or you can listen later wherever you get podcasts. And for a deeper dive into this topic and many others, please check out my book, The Binge Cure, 7 Steps to Outsmart Emotional Eating. It is available on Amazon in every format, including Audible, where I read it to you. So if you want me to read to you, head on over to Amazon. And again, stay curious, not critical. I'll see you next week.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.